Dana is a researcher, author, and advocate who has lived with type 1 diabetes since she was 14 years old. Dana created the first do-it-yourself DIY automated insulin delivery system in 2015. Dana wrote a book about automated insulin delivery systems, covering both commercial systems and DIY systems, and you can check that out at artificialpancreasbook.com. Dana has also written a children's book, Understanding Automated Insulin Delivery, a basic book for kids, family, and friends of people living with type 1 diabetes. And Dana is a frequent published author with 5 published articles already in 2022. Amazing stuff there. She is also a regular speaker at various diabetes-related events and conferences, including ATTD's DDoC event just a few weeks ago. So without further ado, Dana, welcome along to Diabetes Chat tonight. Hey, Dana, how's it going?
Pretty good. Just got back from a run, so all warmed up and ready to go.
Ready to go. I love seeing all your Twitter posts with all the beautiful runs you go on. Every day when I see it, it just brings a smile to my face. I wish I had the motivation to go do it myself, to be honest. but I feel I'm on the same journey as you. I feel I'm there with you when I'm seeing it. So I think that's enough for me.
Well, I'm sure some people find it obnoxious, but kind of at the start of the pandemic, I realized that I needed to get outside and move my body through space every single day. And that was starting with just a walk. And so it was kind of my self-accountability of posting my picture of, yep, I went outside today. I'm alive. I'm doing okay. And I've just enjoyed taking pictures as I run because different people comment on, like, you know, seeing the same spot on my trail through the seasons. It's just kind of fun to observe nature.
So this evening, myself, Chris, Morgan are here, and we have Flipper on speaker, Norman on speaker. We may get people that want to ask questions on the hashtag or jump on the mic. We've got some questions to go through over the course of the next hour or so, if that's cool with you. And like I said, we'll try and get some interactions with the Diabetes Chat community. But before we get going, the last couple of weeks we've been doing this new feature with our guest speakers called the 90-second questions. And what it is some just quick fire round of questions, sort of one word answer sort of thing. And then what I'll do is I'll put it into a video next week, and then I'll publish it online. And it's just like a nice feature we do. Are you up for a little bit of fun?
Sounds good.
Sounds good. Let's go. What's your name?
Dana Lewis.
Occupation?
Researcher and writer.
When were you diagnosed with diabetes and what age?
Age 14, so 19 years ago.
Your favorite hypo treatment?
Airhead minis right now.
Type 1 complications, yes or no?
No.
Do you use insulin pens or pump?
Pump.
Do you feel finger prick?
Occasionally.
What CGM do you use?
G6.
What's worse, feeling hypo or feeling hyper?
It depends. Hypo when running, hyper any other time.
Are you hyper aware?
Yeah.
What 3 symptoms, if you have 3, do you have of hypos?
Feeling wobbly. If I get really low, I get really, really sweaty. And I just feel like the ground is not stable underneath me.
When you finger pricked back in the day, did you change lancets every day?
No.
I don't think anyone did they?
I did for a month.
One thing you like about your diabetes?
It taught me how to be a really, really good emergency backup planner.
One thing you don't like about your diabetes?
Not being able to control what happens to my body in the long run.
Do you love or hate the smell of insulin?
It doesn't bother me, but I hate the smell of alcohol prep pads.
Alrighty. And last of all, if you are on a desert island, what 3 things would you take? And it can include diabetes things.
I'm going to say my open source AID system is one. That's kind of cheating because it's multiple components. And my phone. And probably at this point, I would say some enzymes so I could eat food on the desert island.
There we go. Thank you so much, Dana. That was amazing. So yeah, we'll head over to Chris. He's got some questions. He's going to talk a little bit about with you, your background, of where it all began with your diabetes and DIY and all that, and then we'll check in shortly.
Sounds good.
Hey, Dana.
Hey, Chris.
It's been a while. I think the last time we actually talked was when you were in San Diego. It feels like a decade ago.
I was going to say that was at least a couple years pre-pandemic, right?
Yeah.
So it's like a decade.
All right. So just getting started with your type 1 journey. You were diagnosed at 14, or at least that's what I read.
Yes, that is correct.
What symptoms did you have? What prompted the journey to the emergency room or the hospital?
I actually didn't end up in an ER hospital. I had what, looking back now, was a really great diagnosis experience. So I was 14. I was heading into high school, and I had been part of my high school color guard, which is, you know, spinning the flags alongside the marching band. And we had been working out. We had like week-long camps all through the summer, Alabama heat. So I was working really hard, sweating lots, drinking lots because it's the Alabama summer, losing weight because I was working out, you know, for weeks on end, and just gradually not feeling really great and drinking lots, et cetera, et cetera. And by the time October rolled around, I started to feel like, gosh, I'm really tired. You know, I'm not feeling well. I'm drinking so much. Maybe I'm sick. And so I had a fall break, and my parents and I said, okay, if I'm not feeling well by the time I'm rested and back from fall break, they'll take me to the doctor. And so I went to the doctor the Monday after fall break. Pretty immediately, doctor came in. It was my primary care provider and said, yeah, you have diabetes. You need to go to the endocrinologist. And so I went from the primary care doctor to the endocrinologist, had my first finger stick blood sugar reading. I remember it being like 535 or something. And that was with like 24 hours of fasting because I didn't feel like eating and I was drinking tons. Did my first insulin shot, and the pediatric endocrinologist was really kind, was saying, you know, you could go to the hospital, but I don't think that's the right thing for you. I'm going to send you home. You know, you're going to call me every 2 hours. I'll tell you what to dose, what to inject. And so I was able to go back to school within 2 days. You know, I did some intensive diabetes education and went back to school. And I'm really grateful for that experience because my number one goal was I want to be a normal teenager. I don't want people to know that I have diabetes. I just want to get back, like, figure out what I need to know, get back to living my life. And so I was really able to skip the hospital, skip the ER, and a lot of the trauma that I know people have with the diagnosis experience, and kind of go back to school and do my thing, but with insulin. So it was relatively speaking, a good experience.
Did your parents, did you remember anything about how they coped, or any support that they gave or anything? 14 is a little bit older than at least a good number of people get diagnosed at.
Yeah. I mean, I was and am very lucky. My parents are amazing. They were fantastic about it. I was at that age where they could have done everything or I could have done everything. And they really let me lead. I wanted to, you know, do things on my own, and they supported as needed and as requested. But I was really doing things on my own. And that first week was kind of a weird schedule week where by Friday night, I was wanting to go back to performing with the color guard at the Friday night football game. And my parents let me, and I didn't think anything of it. But then, you know, months and years later, I heard the story of my mom sitting in the field, you know, in stands, just petrified, not knowing what was going to happen to me, you know, within a week of my diagnosis of, was I going to keel over on the field? Was I going to be okay? But, you know, they really held on to that fear and anxiety. They didn't project that onto me. They let me, you know, do what I wanted to do and what I needed to do. And they figured out how to support me. Like, we put lifesavers tucked into my shoes for the performance. So I always had carbs on my body on the field if I needed them. You know, and they were just really great about, you know, supporting me and getting me the resources I wanted. And in fact, I think, you know, they are the reason I became an advocate, because they taught me how to advocate for myself. They really role modeled that. I remember when I finally decided to get a pump, I didn't want to pump at first because I felt like visibly it would label me as a person with diabetes. And I was in Alabama, a lot of stigma then, still now. But eventually I decided I wanted a pump. It was worth dealing with the stigma, and the insurance company denied it. And my dad sat down and printed out like inches and inches and inches of paper and physically mailed it to the insurance company and got it approved. And so I remember that act of, you know, pushing back against insurance denial and advocating for me. And they just constantly, you know, demonstrated and role modeled that for me. And so I learned it from them. And I always feel very, very fortunate that I had their support from day one and along the way. And that really shaped a lot of how, you know, I then, as I, you know, grew up and left the house and was on my own, was able to advocate for myself and then hopefully advocate for other people as well as needed.
Do you think there's more or less stigma or the same just in general now, whether it be your area or, you know, more globally?
I like to think that there's less stigma overall, but I still think that there's pockets of just not information. And this is for all types of diabetes. And it doesn't matter what type of diabetes you have. There's some people who just hear diabetes and they think you don't take care of yourself or you did this to yourself. You know, and I feel in my heart for people with different types of diabetes where we're just, you know, facing this experience and depending on where you are in your diabetes journey and honestly what your blood sugar is at the moment, you know, just the physical and the emotional response to that type of encounter can be really, really hard. So I feel like there's a little less stigma overall in the world because there is more knowledge and education about what diabetes is and what it means. And we've had some amazing role models in the world that show that people with diabetes, if you want, can do whatever it is that you want to do. But at the same time, I still, you know, see and experience and hear stories of people who still face a lot of stigma. So it's like, it's better, but it's still not where it should be, which is frustrating.
All right. Getting into what you're famous for, what prompted you to create a DIY system? What was that, well, that initial impetus?
So I grew up and I went to college and then I ended up moving to Seattle, which is, for those who don't know the U.S., it's on the opposite side of the country. And I lived by myself because I was working a job and I was on a CGM at that time. And I am a champion sleeper. This is what I should be famous for, but I'm not. I sleep really well, really long, and my brain doesn't like waking up to anything, including CGM alarms. And I thought it was because the alarms weren't very loud. And my brain was just used to the sound. And so I had spent years begging the CGM companies to make the alarms different and louder. And they kept saying, we're working on it. It's going to be out in the quote next version, which we all know what that meant. And so finally I was so frustrated and I was like, you know, if I could only get my CGM data off this stupid physical receiver, I could put it, you know, send it to my phone and use a phone app and make a different alarm every single night so that I would wake up to the CGM alarms. And so that was actually what I set out to do, was to make a louder, different CGM alarm. And that's actually the first system that I made. I used John Kostick's code to get the CGM data off the physical receiver. We put it actually in an Excel file in Dropbox and then put it up in the cloud. And we had an app that when that file was updated, if the number was below or above a threshold, would make an alarm. And then because of that, we actually started to add a bunch of smart rules to it saying, okay, if my blood sugar is low, but I've pressed a button saying I took carbs. So I started building in rules to the system. And it was all about this smarter, better alarm to actually wake me up at night and then don't keep alarming if I've already taken action. And adding in remote monitoring components so that if I didn't wake up to the alarm, my loved ones could get access to the alarm and they could call and check on me. And then because we had built the louder alarm, the set of smart rules to decide to tell me what to do if I was high or low, we then worked with Ben West and figured out we could communicate with my insulin pump and realized we could close the loop by sending those requests, not to the human, but directly to the pump. So it's always really fun for me to recount this story because we didn't set out to build an automated insulin delivery system. I wanted a louder alarm, and then I just wanted to sleep through the night. So this was all designed around giving me a lot more sleep. So we did a whole lot of work to build a louder alarm that then we designed an automated insulin delivery system to deal with things so it doesn't actually generate many alarms anymore, which is pretty great. So yeah, the impetus was a louder alarm, and then, hey, we can close the loop. Let's try closing the loop. This is great. Let's keep using it.
Were there big challenges in getting all the pieces to talk to each other? I mean, obviously John had done his work, which eventually became Night Scout. I don't know if it was officially Night Scout at that point yet or not.
It's not. Yeah, it was kind of cool how we used those different pieces and we did it at different times. So it was November, December 2013 when we reached out to John and asked for his code. And so when I say we here, it's usually referring to myself and Scott Librand, who's my boyfriend at the time, now my husband. And this system was designed the way I was trying to teach him how to deal with diabetes. If I was incapacitated, he wanted rules, like, what do I do? And that's how we realized we could teach a computer the rules. So we kind of went out of, first you use John's code and get the data onto the computer. Then we figured out how to get it into use an app called Pushover to make the alarms based on what the blood sugar was. Then we figured out how to give the rule system to the app so it only alarmed if the blood sugar was, you know, high or low and they hadn't pushed a button. And then, like I said, Ben had spent years figuring out how to reverse engineer the pump communications. And so it was really a matter of basically plugging all the pieces together. But I had the smart alarm system in December 2013. And then I actually closed the loop. It was either like November 30th or December 1st, right around there, 2014. And so it wasn't a year of working on that. It was a year of having the system and progressively making it better. And then probably took a couple of weeks to close that last loop piece of communicating with the pump and putting it all together. So altogether, yeah, it was a lot of work, but it was spread over time, kind of tackling these concrete chunks of work as we figured out, oh, we can do the next thing and we can do the next thing. So it very much was a iterative snowball project, not doing it all at once.
Dana, you're like this quickly. I didn't know about Android APS until I actually joined Diabetes Chat 4 or 5 weeks ago now. I actually coded myself an app for Windows because I wasn't waking up to my alarms either on my phone. And all it did is it used a freely available app that you could download. It read my notifications, and if the text low was in the notification from a certain app, it'd ping it over to a database, and I'd have an app on my PC that was essentially on all the time at that point, that'd play a progressively louder alarm, kind of like a normal alarm clock. And if I didn't respond to the message box, it'd actually text my parents or, you know, anyone I put the number into to do it. So I actually made a similar, so nowhere near as complex as Android APS is, especially now.
Oh,
but I didn't even think that was much of a problem. I thought that was just me, like, you know, not waking up to my alarms. I had a very similar experience with that. So
yeah, well, that's so cool to hear. I mean, that's what I always said very early on. People are like, oh my gosh, it's so novel that you close the loop. And I'm like, anybody would do this if they had lucked into getting the right parts and I had the right parts to put it together and it was the right time in the right place. Social media played a big role in introducing us to, you know, Ben and hearing about John's code and what he was doing with it for his family. And so, yeah, like hearing your story, it just reiterates, yeah, like this type of solution is really common sense and it still surprises me to this day that companies did not financially take advantage of this need to sell better and more products because there was a market there. Not everybody would have thought of the creative solution the way you did with your Windows box or, you know, what we did with Dropbox in this app called Pushover. You know, it was very, very hacky, but it was
Mine was very similar to Pushover. I used something called MacroDroid on my PC. On my phone, MacroDroid. Mm-hmm. All it did is read my notifications, and that literally just pushed it to a database on the web.
Yeah. Yeah. Necessity is the parent of invention, I think, is a common phrase we hear.
Yep, that sounds about right. Chris?
All right. Let's see, we kind of covered that. Sorry, half the time when you're answering questions, you wind up answering like the next two or three that I had as well, Dana. So,
sorry about that.
not your fault. It just means that we sort of think the same way, I think. let's see, there's been sort of a clear through line from John's work and developing Night Scout and making it available to the broader community. But I mean, OpenAPS was out years before any commercial DIY system on the market. Do you think the DIY is still driving commercial innovation and changes and improvements?
Oh, absolutely. For those who don't know, what I built first, my louder alarm system, we called DIYPS, kind of as a joke, do-it-yourself pancreas system, even though it wasn't obviously a fully functioning pancreas. We automated insulin delivery system. We called OpenAPS to stand for Open Source Artificial Pancreas System because we then shared it as open source. That way, individuals could use it, researchers could use it, doctors could use it, companies ideally could use it. And what's been really cool is there's not only been multiple open source systems that have evolved from that. You might have heard of Loop, uses a different algorithm, iPhones, or Android APS, which uses the same algorithm from OpenAPS on an Android phone. And so not only have these other open source systems evolved from OpenAPS, But we made our algorithm open source, hoping that companies would use it. And so there have actually been companies who have taken and tested our code, ported it, run it side by side, and found places where the algorithm outperforms what they had designed. And they took our safety rules and added it into their commercial system. And they're running it in their commercial regulatory marked approved system because it's safer, which I think is phenomenal and kind of supersedes what we had hoped would come out of this. Like I built the system for me because I wanted to sleep. And I thought if anybody else wants to use it, they should be able to use it. And we kind of had this pipe dream of, okay, maybe this will help commercial companies do better, go faster, do more, but we weren't quite sure how that would happen. But we saw really early on, because it was open source, it did enable these commercial systems who wanted to take advantage of that. And we have been able to continue to iterate on the algorithm and usability features, things like auto sensitivity, looking at automatic detection of things happening in your body, regardless of what's causing that, or things like auto-tune to help people adjust their settings, as well as just being able to look and see different, because we've solved so many noisy problems without knowing what they are, you can see changes in the body happening or phenomenon like how the body deals with meals when you have less insulin activity in your body going into a meal or not. So some of you may have heard of something called eating soon, which is basically a concept of if you have a little bit of insulin active in your body, your meal goes way better, regardless of how and when you meal bolus, versus if you had been, you know, not getting insulin for hours going into a meal. So these concepts of like discovering what is happening in the body with insulin timing and things like that, we've been able to discover and figure some of this stuff out and then give it to researchers and give it to companies and beg them to do more with it. And we're starting to see that. So it does feel like even now, it feels like it's been 7 or 8 years. It feels like a very, very long time, even if you exclude pandemic timing. And but it's been really, really cool to see that the diabetes community, Chris, yourself included, has continued to research and discover stuff and test things out. And I think we'll continue to see that feed into commercial and academic research spaces for another several years, just because there's so many unsolved problems in diabetes.
Well, there's lots of things that wind up on posters and then go to posters to die, it seems like, things that should be explored that nobody has the time or funding to dig into.
Unfortunately, yeah. But hopefully the community is changing that. I think the fact that we all now have social media to connect and share ideas and to drop and pick up ideas at different time based on interests and ideas and skills. Hopefully that means fewer ideas just sit in a poster and die compared to before.
Is there anything that you would change or make different about the original OpenAPS reference design that now, based on all of your experience and working with it and the various things that people have done with it, if you had it to go back and start over from scratch?
I don't think so. I think we took a very conservative, cautious approach that was designed around anybody who uses a system should understand their diabetes and learn the system and be able to turn it, you know, up and down as their comfort level, you know, prefers. And I still think that was and is the right thing to do. And we added on features. One of my favorite things that most people really don't know about the community is we iterated on the algorithm. We designed the system as a hybrid closed loop because I didn't have a lot of issue with post-meal highs. I wanted, you know, mostly overnight coverage. Again, it always comes back to sleep. But as, you know, dozens of people started using OpenAPS, the feedback was, we wish the system would do more around meals. And we're like, well, I'm not really having, you know, an issue with meals. So it's kind of hard to design based on a problem we don't know a lot about. So we really worked with the community and we're looking at data from people who, you know, shared it and talked with us about how the system performed at meals. And we iterated on the algorithm. We had what we called meal assist that people could enable it to do more around meals. And then that became advanced meal assist, AMA. And then that just became part of the algorithm that everybody today just uses. Like that's the default algorithm just because it evolved over time. So we really started with what is the way we can design this to be as safe as possible for everybody. You know, if they just turn it on without thinking, which they shouldn't do, we want them to learn and use it and turn on features. So that was always the approach, was design around safety. And that I think was the right thing to do. And looking back, I think we would do it the same way all over again. But it is really fun to look back and see progressively how we all as a community learned. And then you can see the little bits of the algorithm evolved and improved along as, you know, we had different edge cases that we found and different community members had requests for like, oh, I'd like it to do, you know, more in this situation and things like that.
Do you see technical challenges that are on the horizon that are still need to be overcome? Improvements things like CGM accuracy or the insulin speed or things like that that'll help continue to push things forward?
Obviously, the more accurate the CGM is, the better. I think, you know, the challenge is just the real world. Keep a CGM on your body with data going. Hopefully, future generations of CGM sensors will have longer wear time, less warm-up time, less noise in the first couple hours or days. You know, many of us in the community have worked around that by trying to soak sensors, by having a sensor sitting there, getting the jumpiness out before you actually use the data in a closed loop system. But hopefully, you know, the next generations of commercial sensors will mean that you don't need to do that. Obviously, I would love, just like everybody would, faster insulin, faster in, faster out. I think that's one of the challenges is, you know, especially for people like me who do exercise, is you can, you know, plan all you want, but if you have insulin pooled under your site and you go out for a run, even if you supposedly have zero or negative IOB, that can go whoosh and you can have a low and it's super frustrating. And it just, that is the reality of today's insulins. So I think the faster insulins get, you know, the easier it is to make an algorithm do more quickly because you have the insulin that would go more quickly. But I also would love for innovations around pump sites and the insulin to go away at a certain point in time if it's not actually taken action in your body because of that ability for it to pool and go whoosh during exercise or even a walk. That the walks can get you too.
Most definitely. And that's actually an excellent segue into me handing this off to Tom to talk about exercise and distance running and training and hiking and all that fun stuff.
Brilliant. Cheers, Chris. What a fascinating chat so far, Dana. And if anyone wants to join the discussion or ask any specific questions about OpenAPS or anything you said already, please hashtag diabetes chat or request a mic. So I know we touched upon it at the start, really, but let's go over it in a bit more detail. What motivated you to start your distance running and hiking? And can you tell us a little bit about your races and how many marathons you've ran?
So in 2013, this is actually my profile picture. I decided I wanted to run a marathon and I didn't run at that time. So I went from zero to running the marathon, did it, was really, really proud of it and said never again. And then in 2014 to like 2017, I ran maybe 50 or 60 miles a year, not very much. But with a little bit of time, I was like, you know what? I really liked the process of planning my training and having something to focus on. I think I want to do this again. So in 2018, I decided to try to increase my running a little bit. And by a little bit, I mean to like 100 miles in the year instead of 50. And that I was going to train and run another marathon in 2019. And then I had a little detour because in January 2019, I was on a multi-day hike in New Zealand. Wonderful experience, except for I ended up leaving the mountains via helicopter after I fell off the trail and broke my ankle in three places. So I had to recover from the broken ankle and learn how to walk again, which actually made me more determined to come back and run my marathon. I decided not to do it that same year. I was going to move it to 2020. Just because I didn't think between, you know, February and July, I'd be ready. I wanted to, you know, do it right this time. So I was like, okay, I'll run in July 2020, and was returning to running that year and, you know, really motivated to overcome the injury. And then by the end of February 2020, I live in the Seattle area. We had the very first US detected COVID case, and I went, this is not good. And I don't think I'll be running my race this year. And sure enough, races were canceled, everything happened. And so I just kind of solo ran in 2020 and was really determined to come back in 2021. And that was going to be the marathon year finally. So that was last year and I did it. And I also had said, you know, if I train really, really well and do a marathon, which is 26.2 miles, I want to try to find a ultra marathon, the shortest one I can do, which is typically a 50K race, which is 31 miles. And if I can get the timing lined up a few more miles, typically speaking, And I lucked out into finding a 50K that was about 2.5 months after my marathon. So last year, I ran my marathon at end of July, recovered for a couple weeks, kind of returned to baseline training, and then ran a 50K last year. And then realized I liked the process of, I'm not fast, by the way. I am very, 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 very slow. You'll notice I never, ever talk about my paces. I'm run walking.
Do you try and beat your personal best, or are you just doing it to just do it the race?
A lot of it is to just, I mean, I'm always trying to beat my previous, like I wanted to beat my first marathon time last year, which I did. It's very much about improving myself and pushing myself based on where I am, you know, and what I can do. But I'm very slow. I run walk. I tend to run 30 seconds, walk 60 seconds, because I found that that is what enables me to go as long as I want to go. And that feels really good to my body. And it also helps me not compare myself to anybody else. Even if I was running nonstop, I'm always faster. I'm always slower than my brothers and my husband and everybody else. I just can't compete. And so I literally run my own race and try to focus on doing what I can do best. And it just makes it way more enjoyable that way.
Absolutely. It's just amazing and just pure inspiring. So, you know, like obviously to train for your marathons, are you training out on the road, not the roads, but out in the countryside, or do you do a bit of training in the gym as well on like treadmills and stuff? How do you sort of typically train in the season prep in preparation for the marathon?
I probably would do some treadmill running, except for this, again, was all happening in the midst of the pandemic. And so I did not feel safe going to my community gym. So I've done everything outside, which is both good because you have the mental health benefits of, you know, feeling the breeze on your face and moving your body through space. But as you've probably, those of you who've seen my run pictures know that I live in Seattle and it's kind of wet a lot and cold a lot, like 8 months out of the year. So there's a lot of rainy, wet, grumpy running, which is kind of challenging, but I oftentimes will like look at the calendar for the day and look at the forecast for the day and say, okay, here's the hour that it's not going to be raining, or it'll be raining less. This is the hour. And I try to move around meetings or blocks of work so that I get to go outside and run when it's a little less wet.
When you're obviously preparing for the training or just going out for a run, or like say you're preparing for extended exercise like long hikes or marathons, how do you sort of manage that with your diabetes and like carry for hypos? Do you have a kit? Do you have your essentials with you? How do you sort of manage your sort of pump and your APS system? And do you have any sort of temporary basal settings, or do you have anything that you have to change for these circumstances? Do you do it before you go, or do you manage it during the run itself?
A little bit of both. What I try to do is reduce the insulin on board prior before a run. So ideally for me, that often on a short run day, that looks like I might eat breakfast, try to wait 2 hours and then go for a run, because most of the peak insulin activity is through my body. And what I typically do again is try to time it as such. So it's 2 hours after a meal, not while I'm actively got a bunch of IOB on board. And what I often do if the time period isn't as flexible for that is I will set a high target in my system, which helps it reduce insulin before I go out and run. But like I mentioned earlier, sometimes you could have zero IOB or negative IOB according to your system, and there could still be insulin sitting under your pump site that gets activated by your muscles and you're going to go low anyway. So I always carry carbs. I wear pockets and pants with pockets or shorts with pockets. And I always have carbs stuffed in there. And then on my longer runs, I also carry a pack that's got a hydration bladder in it with a hose and lots of carbs and backup carbs. And then if I'm doing a race and my husband is crewing me or meeting me on the course, I've always got an extra baggie full of emergency backup carbs ready to swap out if I need it.
So what sort of carbs do you have then? What sort of treatments would you take for your hypos on your runs?
So I have these little, they're not mints like peppermints, but they're kind of like a soft peppermint, but different flavors are like a dissolvey sugary thing that I really like, because when I get tired of chewing and swallowing on really, really long runs, they kind of dissolve in your mouth on their own. So those are nice. And those are four or five carbs and I use those. Or lately I've been using little Airhead minis. I don't know if these are something that the UK or international folks have. It's a US candy. It's kind of a chewy fruit strip thing that's all sugar. The minis are about 8 carbs and they lay really flat. They're like a little flat strip. So they work really well to sit in even a small pocket because you could put like 5 on top of each other and they flatten really well. So they're a pretty efficient high carb ratio to low space in your pocket. Yeah. So I've been using those a lot this year.
And I assume you obviously, you know, your levels throughout your run, and I assume you take these treatments as before you're obviously hitting that hypo so that you can obviously keep going rather than getting to that hypo stage and, oh no, we're in hypo. So I presume you sort of know what levels you need to be taking these treatments so you can continue on with the run. Is that right?
Yeah. And I've gotten, I would say, like, learning to run and starting to run is way different than when you've gotten your body into dropping, I should take 4 carbs or I should take 8 carbs. The more practice you have, the better. But yeah, I've got kind of a fine-tuned system. I try to run myself between like 110 to 130 milligrams per deciliter. That's probably, I don't know if that's 6 to 6.5-ish. I'm probably converting wrong, but a slightly higher, but still a reasonable number. And then I keep an eye on it. And if I start dipping a little bit, I might pop 4 carbs. If I dip more, you know, or I'm suddenly, you know, it's falling off a cliff shape, you know, then I might do an 8 grams of carbs and keep an eye on it.
Has diabetes ever got on your way with your sort of running, hiking and marathons? Like, have you ever had an episode that you've had to stop, and whether it's a short break or a prolonged break, or no, I can't do this anymore, or do you feel like the technology, the APS has enabled you to fulfill this running?
You know, I feel like before I had my APS, it played more of a role in causing more pauses during hikes and stuff. Actually, I remember on an early first date with Scott, this is one of the things that got him really interested in, you know, how can I help? How can I understand? Which I think is just showed how different he is from most people, because we went on a walk after dinner. And so, of course, this is, again, pre-APS. I had a bunch of IOB. We went for a spontaneous walk. I started going low. We stopped at a bench. I was scarfing down Skittles, you know, and he was asking questions about, like, why did you go low? I'm like, dude, I have diabetes. It happens. And he's like, no, I get that. But, you know, help me understand what are all the variables that causes this so that we can help try to prevent it, which was, you know, so thoughtful and kind. And so I explained things about, you know, IOB and exercise, making it go whoosh, and how it's nice to know if I'm going to go walk after dinner, et cetera, et cetera. And then we also had some hikes early on where even without IOB, I just, you know, my blood sugar dropped and it felt better to pause and eat than keep going and eating. So there's still times now where, you know, I'll stop and want to eat and wait for the carbs to kick in. And unfortunately, I'm also very, very stubborn. So a lot of times I will want to keep going, and Scott is more likely to say, hey, let's stop. Here's a bench. Here's a convenient place to stop and wait for your carbs to kick in. And sometimes I'm just like, no, let's keep going, because I didn't plan to stop. And if I didn't plan to stop, I don't want to stop.
Yeah.
So I'm sure some folks can relate to that.
Absolutely. I'm sure. And I'm sure there's quite a few people listening, really intrigued with the chat so far. How often would you say you check your levels while competing? Are you just like simply glancing down at the CGM? Is the alarms buzzing off at you? And do you ever require to stop to finger prick while competing or in training or whatnot?
I usually don't take my meter on. I like, if I'm doing that one multi-day hike, I obviously had my meter because it was multiple days, but usually my CGM is reliable enough that I can just, you know, check the app or glance at it on my watch. Last year for my 50K, I did put on a second sensor of a different type, a flash monitor. That way I just had a backup just in case something went wrong with my regular primary CGM. Wasn't an issue, but I just felt like, okay, if I'm going to be out here for 7 or 8 hours, I'd rather have the backup just in case.
Safety blanket.
So I'll probably continue to do that just because I bought these sensors off on eBay for scuba diving and things like this. And it's worth the, you know, $15 or $20 I paid for it out of pocket just to have the redundancy versus carrying my meter.
Yeah. And you've talked a little bit about the ultramarathon. You say that's 50K, yeah?
An ultramarathon is anything over a marathon. In my case, last year it was a 50K. This year I am planning both a 50K, which I'll do in 2 weeks from now. I'm also looking at a 50-mile race in September.
And how does that sort of increased distance affect your preparation?
It just requires a lot more running of a lot more miles. I kind of overtrain for a lot of my races. I ran a marathon in training and prep for my marathon. I actually ran a 50K 3 weeks ago. So I'm, familiar with the distance, and it's just, getting your body used to running for those extra hours. I won't quite train all the way up to 50 miles for the 50 miles just because it's so long and the risk for injury goes up even as slow as I'm running. But I will probably get to hopefully a 36 mile run in prep for my 50 and then follow it up with like a 15 or 20 mile run the next day. So that's fingers crossed. Hopefully we'll see how I recover from my 50K and what I feel like doing in the peak of summer.
That's just sensational. Wow. So in terms of your typical training session, how far are you going? Obviously we see the beautiful images like you keep updating us. How far do you run for, and how long is that sort of run last? And do you kind of have a sort of competition with yourself to go, right, let's see if I can shave 10 seconds off? Or like, do you have a bit of, is there any prep? Is there anything different like between each sort of day? But I guess, like you said before, the weather may influence or whatnot. But I guess if you've got the strategies of you tend to go 2 hours after you've eaten your breakfast.
So I do a lot of things differently. I actually wrote a blog post about that. If anybody's interested, shoot me a note and I can send you a link to this post. Most people will train 2 weeks longer each week, and then they'll cut back on the third or fourth week. I do every other week. So I'll do 20 miles, and the next week I would do 12 miles, and then I do 22 and then 14. So I kind of progressively make my long runs longer, but I swap every other week, and partially because like psychologically, it just takes me so long to run. And so spending the same amount of time every week and putting that into my schedule is just kind of hard to do. But also psychologically, it feels better to go every other week. So I spend a longer time doing these long runs and building up to my ultimate distance. But I've just found that that works really well for me psychologically and physically. I seem to recover better. And I end up enjoying it more. So nothing's really different, whether I'm running 2 hours or I'm running 6 or 7 or 8 hours. I kind of do all the same things, but I obviously carry more water and more fuel and more low carbs the longer I go.
Yeah. And you have earphones with you? Are you listening to music on your runs?
I used to listen to only music, but this year I started listening to audiobooks and podcasts, and that makes everything feel a lot smoother. Yeah. I love to read. I read a lot, but I've always been a read on my phone, not audiobook person. But when you're out there for 6 to 8 hours, it just really helps you get into the flow to have, some type of audio that's like 30 minutes or longer versus songs that change every 3 minutes. I've found that it helps me just kind of stay in the flow of running and not get so distracted every 3 minutes. So
I can see that. I can really see that. I can imagine, running and you're pumped up because the song is going, but then the song ends and then you're waiting for the next one and you're kind of kicking yourself back up. But I guess if you got a 30-minute podcast or whatever, you're pumped up listening for 30 minutes. And I can see that really, really so. So who knows, you may be listening to the diabetes chat on your runs in the future.
my long run days are usually Mondays, so that actually works out well if I have cell signal.
Love it. Okay, I'm gonna head over to Morgan. She's gonna hit some questions about your sort of speaking, writing, research, and then maybe we'll check in again with some other areas. Over to you, Morgan.
Thank you, Tom. Hi, Dana. Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for coming on. I'll try and go kind of quickly through these just so we can make sure to get through everything that we have. First one I have is like, even prior to the creation of OpenAPS, you were starting to publish on the topic of social media and healthcare. What are the challenges that online communities can face as they grow and evolve?
So I've observed, so I actually ran a hashtag chat when Tom was talking about, starting the first diabetes chat, Twitter space and stuff. It gave me flashbacks to starting one of the very, very first hashtag chats back when hashtags were kind of a new thing. So I've kind of seen different communities evolve on different platforms, and there are just community like evolutionary cycles that happen any community, regardless of what platform it's on. And so I think the challenges are just recognizing as community moderators, like y'all are, or community organizers, that you will have some people come back every single week. You will have new people come on. you will have some people leave and it's nothing that you did. It's just where it is in their life or whatever. And you have some folks who are there every week and kind of become community elders, and they might take on different roles in the community. So just recognizing that there's different kind of community roles and there's a different life cycle in communities. And that's any community, any topic, any platform, you kind of see it happen over and over again. So it's not so much challenge as just realizing that, you know, just there's these different community roles that people play, you know, consciously or subconsciously, they're going to change over time. And just being aware of that, because then you can kind of see, oh, wow, gosh, we have this really great elder community, or wow, we've got a lot of new folks. And here's what we should do to meet new folks and engage with them.
Yeah, that it's a lot of accepting and realizing that it might not be like, you know, anything that you're personally doing.
Exactly.
So what are you currently like working on research wise?
I am always working on research related to something with automated insulin delivery, but I also just published a paper I was partnering with this group that was doing some user research with folks who are aging with type 1 diabetes, because obviously we have all these great tools and technologies and people with diabetes are living longer than ever, which is awesome. But it also means that there's new challenges, whether that's complications or just dealing with the healthcare system. Regardless of what age you are, the healthcare system doesn't necessarily know what a CGM and a pump are, let alone a closed loop, and how to deal with that, whether you're there for, you know, a flu test or a broken ankle surgery or something, you know, more serious like a hospital stay. And so really trying to listen to the community and highlight the needs of people who are aging and try to help translate that for the healthcare system to see, here's how the healthcare system should be listening, engaging, and adapting, but at the same time saying, what tools can we provide to people with diabetes for when they engage with the healthcare system? One of those is a diabetes advanced directive, which is kind of playing on the concept of an advanced directive. It's usually used for end of life care. Like, what do you want as you reach the end of your life, whether it's, you know, you're dying happily of old age, or you've got a situation like cancer that might expedite the end of your life. The idea of a diabetes advanced directive is if you go in for a broken ankle surgery, or you go in for a planned hospitalization, or you're pregnant and about to give birth, or whatever, that you've got an outline of, here are my wishes for what tools I use, how I want to self-manage or not in the hospital. And here are the people who can help, either whether that's, you know, my healthcare team, or, you know, my spouse or my friend who I've trained to be my advocate. So really looking at what are these kind of tools that we can create for people with diabetes and make them available. So that's just an example of a project that caught my eye that I really wanted to help with and try to use as a springboard to get a lot of other people interested in researching. And that tends to be the kind of thing that I work on. It's often very early. How can I, you know, do the first thing, establish the evidence, and get other people interested in saying, this is a space we can study, we can focus, we can build tools here. So that's an example of one I've done recently.
Yeah. So do you have like a ballpark of the number of like conferences and, you know, just places you've spoke about, you know, about your research, like how many times that you've done that, and if there's any particular topic you are passionate about speaking beyond open source AID systems?
Gosh, probably dozens. I don't know exactly how many. but yeah, I think what I really like to talk about is the data and the new concepts of diabetes that we can better study now that we have both commercial and open source AID. That's kind of my new pet topic, is pointing out there's all these things that we can discover because we've solved so much of the variability and the stupid noise that's messing with our blood sugars. We people with diabetes know that you can do the same thing, but because of, you know, however many variables affect our blood sugar, you can get a totally different result. Well, when you have a system that automatically adjusts for the bulk of those, you start to see other things happening in the body, and there's new things about diabetes that we're learning. And so kind of my mission right now is to try to help educate the healthcare system of, we have this data from these systems, we should be using it. And to kind of tie into, I'm sure somebody at some point will ask me about exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, or EPI. I personally, you know, started on this new medication to help me digest my food. And you can look at my diabetes data and see, a difference in the variability of my blood sugars, because when I started digesting everything that I was eating, the combination of fat and protein meant that I wasn't absorbing all the carbs first. And so my blood sugar response was differently shaped than if before, when I wasn't taking enzymes, mostly just the carbs were absorbing. So that's just an example of, if you have people using these AID systems, whether they're commercial or open source, we can learn things about what these medications actually do for people with diabetes. And I think that there's a lot of potential for drugs like metformin and a lot of other drugs where people say, oh, blood sugar goes high or blood sugar goes low. We don't know. Watch out for both. Well, if you're newly put on this medication, that's not helpful at all, right? As a person with diabetes, I know I'm going to go high or low. That's not really helpful. But you don't know, am I going to tend to run low or am I going to tend to run high? Are there different groups of people who respond differently? I think we have the possibility to understand that now because we have AID technology. It's just a matter of using that data effectively. So that's what I am starting to speak more on and hoping to speak more on and publish on and show the capability of that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's like so super interesting. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around everything. But yeah, no, like it's all super fascinating. It seems like the potential for stuff that we kind of already have, but just don't know the full scope of everything that can be done.
Exactly.
Sorry, I lost my place. Okay, so for those that aren't, like, and including me, who aren't super familiar with like research and like designated roles and stuff like that, what does it mean to be a primary investigator on a study?
So principal investigator usually means you are the person who has the idea and is leading the study. It can mean different things. I am not a PhD or a doctor. I'm not what I call a traditional researcher, which means I don't work for an academic university or institution. I'm actually not with any organization. I'm kind of a self-funded researcher. So I tend to be principal investigator because it's my idea and I do the research and I write up the thing. But sometimes I will partner with a doctor or a group of researchers, and I might be a co-investigator, which means I'm just partnering with them on it. So it can mean different things, whether you're talking about like a purely academic group or not, but usually it just means you have the idea and you're the one who's actually doing the work on the study.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Well, thank you so much for answering my questions about like the research and the speaking part. We have two more sections if we have time, but if not, that's totally okay. But
I'm good for a little more time. If people want to keep talking with me, I'm happy to stay as long as there's interest, but realize that there's also community folks that want to connect with each other too.
No, it's totally, because Tom has a section for diabetes advocacy and peer support. And if we had time, Chris was going to talk to you about pancreatic exocrine insufficiency. So
can you, you've sort of already described that, yeah, obviously it's the pancreatic enzymes that you're not getting with the PEI. So the primary treatment is just taking the replacements.
Yeah, so this is something that was brand new to me. I actually had 2 years of GI problems that I wasn't quite sure what was happening. Finally figured out it might be this thing, got tested for it. It's called exocrine pancreatic insufficiency. People in the US tend to use the acronym EPI. I think in the UK and elsewhere, people use PEI. But generally, people with diabetes don't realize that your pancreas has other jobs, one of which is to actually dump out enzymes that then help break down the food that you're eating. And I was diagnosed by getting a lab test that showed that my elastase levels were kind of borderline on the low side, but not fully low. And so I started taking enzyme replacement therapy called PERT. And basically it's quote unquote, just taking enzymes with what you eat, but it's a little bit like insulin. I've discovered that having a ratio, kind of like your insulin to carb ratio, is really, really helpful in deciding what to eat, because you actually have three macronutrients that you're eating. You have carbs, you have fat, and you have protein. And there's actually three types of enzymes that you're low on or missing. And so you're taking these pills to supplement them. But each pill, depending on the brand and the size, is a different type. And so I found that actually counting not only the carbs, but the fat and protein and what I'm eating, and matching that to the amount of enzymes in a pill that I'm taking, gets me a lot better results. So I've learned how to titrate these enzymes and count the fat and the protein as well as the carbs and what I'm eating. And thankfully, I'm now like 4 months in and things are way, way, way better. Just probably the best example I have to how I was feeling last year is with my ultra running. I was running and I just didn't feel like I was recovering. It felt really, really hard. And I thought that was just ultra running, right? Running marathons and farther. It's just hard and you're tired. But this year, you know, with having the enzymes and taking that with what I eat, it adds challenges, but I have so much more energy. And it really reminds me of how I felt like the week before I got diagnosed with diabetes. And then about a month later, once I finally had insulin going and my body felt like it was digesting, you know, and using the energy in your body again, it's that same kind of feeling of having the enzymes in your body working and helping you digest your food. It just feels magical.
Did your insulin needs change? I mean, you kind of touched on this a little bit, but I mean, just thinking, you know, obviously we need insulin to process any sort of energy input, whether it's, you know, broken down or not. So the fact that you're now actually digesting that fat and protein stuff, are you needing a little bit more insulin, like longer term with meals?
It doesn't seem to make a difference. And again, I don't know if that's because I'm in peak ultra running. Like it's not like a really, it's not a great scientific experiment because I am running, you know, anywhere from 30 to 50 miles per week. So it's a little bit, it's not like a straightforward comparison. What I have seen is just the difference in the glucose shape after meals, particularly breakfast, because I eat the same meal before and after and could do a really good comparison and see the glucose goes up, not as high, not as fast. My AID system is able to, you know, dose in response to it more effectively than what I was doing without enzymes, which is why I have the theory that without the enzymes, I was primarily digesting the carbs first. Whereas now it seems like I'm digesting like the full mixed meal as a mixed meal more effectively with the enzymes. So I personally am not seeing a huge difference, but that could be, again, I have an AID, I'm running 50 miles a week, and you know, also I have pretty moderate levels of EPI. Somebody with a lot lower levels, they might see a very different you know, response to insulin or response to what they're eating once they get their enzymes titrated. And that's an example of something I would love to see studied in the research. And I'm trying to start writing some publications and advocating for research. Again, just because I have the opportunity with AID to see, oh, here's what we could study with these medications and EPI, because that's obviously my new area of interest. And I just think there's a lot there we could learn.
Do you have any idea how common EPI may be in people with T1D? I would assume that a lot of it may even be undiagnosed. So do we really even have a ballpark?
So there are some studies that estimate that anywhere from 20 to 40% of people with type 1 diabetes have lowered levels of elastase. So that being said, it sounds like a lot, but most endocrinologists and doctors don't think that in people with diabetes, lowered elastase equals EPI. I'm kind of on the fence about that personally. I think there's a lot of people who are undiagnosed because looking back, I had 2 years of GI symptoms, but even beyond that, like 3 and 4 years ago, I remember these big restaurant meals where I didn't feel good after eating. And I kind of stopped eating them because I couldn't figure out why they were bothering me. I kind of maybe said, I also have celiac. So I said, maybe I got gluten. I don't know. But I realized I had symptoms early on. And I think people with diabetes kind of self-adjust more than the average person to things like that. When you have a meal repeatedly that just doesn't work for you, blood sugar, you don't feel good, you might change what you're eating. So I think a lot of people with diabetes kind of slowly adjust over time. And if they're, you know, lucky like me, this is weird, but like if you're lucky and you have your microbiome get super disrupted and you realize there's something really wrong with your GI, then that might lead you to get diagnosed. But otherwise, there's not an easy blood test like with celiac disease that gets screened for on a regular basis, even though type 1 diabetes is a risk factor alongside with celiac. And so for anybody listening, if you have GI problems at any point in your life, you have diabetes, you should ask about EPI screening. The same way people kind of think to ask about celiac. I think celiac and gastroparesis are also probably at similar rates to EPI, but because EPI doesn't have any easy blood tests to diagnose, it's just not on the radar for endocrinologists or gastroenterologists. I mean, I had to bring it up to mine. It was not on the list of the top like 10 things my GI doctor thought it was.
Can I ask what your symptoms were? Like, you know, when you're saying you weren't feeling well after a meal kind of thing, what were your symptoms for that? Like, what, how were you not feeling well?
So three or four years ago, it was just like, I felt, I didn't have really concrete symptoms, but I just kind of felt icky for a couple hours after I ate. The last 2 years, I had something that messed up my microbiome. And then after that, I didn't recover. Like, my bowel movements were different. And I progressively felt worse. I started having a lot of gas, which I never had before. Sometimes the gas would build up overnight and give me really, really crazy strong abdominal pain, which is what actually sent me to the doctor. Cause I was like, ah, something's wrong. I've got this abdominal pain overnight that's waking me up. That's not normal. But if you have like changes to your bowel movements, it doesn't have to be diarrhea or weight loss. Those are the number two symptoms that people think about with EPI. But if your bowel movements get smelly, sticky, they're just not normal for you over time, that can be a sign. You know, not like your stomach hurting for several hours after you eat. That could be celiac or EPI. Either way, it's worth talking to your endo or getting a GI consult for. But basically, if you have GI symptoms and weeks or months are going by, probably means there's something going on and you should get it checked out. And that's just something I don't think we talk about enough with diabetes. You know, the question during the rapid question earlier was like, do you have complications of diabetes? I was like, no. Well, I don't know if celiac or now EPI is considered, you know, a complication or just an associated thing. But it tends to be pretty prevalent in diabetes and we just don't talk about it enough. So that's kind of my new mission as well, to get people to talk about EPI and realize that we should screen for that alongside celiac.
Thank you for the info.
Yeah. Thanks for asking.
Well, so much diabetes related seems to be thinking about things that come out of our bodies, and it's always a sort of taboo subject. You know, I'm peeing and my urine smells funny. Is what's this a sign of? Or
yeah,
we're all diabetics here, so hopefully we should all understand.
Oh, I think everybody understands. I don't like talking about bodily functions with other people. Like, that's just not something you do. But now that I have EPI, I'm like, I have to suck up my dislike for talking about it and try to describe it in a way that other people would see, you know, and understand what their experience is. And it really comes down to, is this normal for you or not? And if you're concerned, you know, to talk to your doctor. And sometimes doctors have like a really clear cut idea of, these are the symptoms for this thing, whether it be, you know, celiac or EPI. With EPI, like I said, weight loss is really common because people aren't absorbing the nutrients. But if you catch it early, you're not going to have malnutrition, which means you probably don't have weight loss from it. So if you happen to be overweight, or you happen to not have lost weight from wherever you started, doctors aren't going to think about EPI as a possibility. And if you're not having diarrhea, which I wasn't, like, things were different, but it was definitely not diarrhea. And I kept telling my doctor, it's not diarrhea, but it's not normal for me. And it was really hard to explain to my doctor, like, what does it mean for it to not be normal? And what did that mean? And again, it took a year for me to see somebody's post about a dog having EPI to look it up and say, is that a thing in humans? And what does that look like? And oh my gosh, I have the textbook symptoms of, you know, messy stools and not feeling well after eating, et cetera, et cetera. And at that point, we had gone down the list of every other test to do. And so I was like, let's test for this thing, because diabetes and celiac are both risk factors for it. So it took a lot of advocating to even get that diagnosis. But clearly, my response to the enzyme shows that's what I have. And even though it's moderate levels, it, you know, it really surprises me how much better I feel as a result of taking those enzymes, which just makes me feel even more strongly that if there's other people out there with diabetes and, you know, quote unquote, just moderate levels of EPI, it's just like, imagine a bad blood sugar day where you've been up all night with lows and highs and whatever, and you wake up and you just feel like you're at 40% of your normal, and just at way less capacity than everybody else every single day who doesn't have diabetes. Well, with EPI and being without enzymes for so long, I always felt like I was at 30% regardless of what my blood sugars were doing. So even with good blood sugars, I felt like I was at 30% capacity for almost 2 years. And it was really, really frustrating. And so you know, it's hard to describe that you're at 30% because it's like a boiling frog. It gradually gets worse. It's not like you fall off a mountain and break your ankle and clearly something is wrong and something is broken. it's very much a gradual, I don't feel good. I'm not feeling better. It's getting worse. I'm adding these new symptoms of abdominal pain or whatever else. EPI can be really sneaky and really progressive, unfortunately.
Makes you thankful for the doctors that actually have the charts with the various pictures of so your bowel movements, are they number one, number two, number four, number six?
That's called the Bristol stool chart, and you can use that, and that may or may not be helpful for what you're experiencing.
All right. The last question I had was about red flags, but I think we've largely covered that with celiac and diabetes being risk factors and the GI symptoms that are things that people should watch out for and bring up with their healthcare professionals if they do experience them. Oh, I was just going to say I'm going to toss it back to Tom to talk a little bit about advocacy and peer support.
Sounds good.
Brilliant. Flipper, I know you're on the line as well. I know you sent a question on the hashtag. Did you want to ask your question directly or do you want me to read it out?
Hi, can you hear me?
We can.
Brilliant. No, I was just wondering, Donna, and hi, I did meet you years ago just before the combo. Yes. And I said at that point, oh, I'm going to spend a bit of time and just understand it. And 3 weeks later, I was looping. And I had to buy a phone as well. My question was, with you saying that you, and I've sort of read your research and it's you're publishing this, how does the traditional community take that? Because you're not coming from a traditional route to publish papers.
You know, I feel like the diabetes world has taken it really, really well. I don't feel like I've run into any barriers because I don't, from people. The systems are set up such that when you go to submit an article, it really wants you to have an institution. And I don't have an institution, so I have to be creative about how I fill in this mandatory field and then write a note to the publishing team that says, hey, please don't reject my paper as an editorial step because I don't have a Ringgold verified organization. Here's why I don't. And thankfully now I have a track record where I can say, I am a published researcher. Look at my ORCID record. Here's all my publications. And they're pretty good about not auto-rejecting me anymore. Not making me send that email to get my paper then into the peer review system. So there's some structural barriers like that where it's just, you have to learn how do I submit my research into the system that's not really designed for people like me. But in terms of once you get the article, they don't care whether you're a Harvard doctor or an HS doctor. The research is peer reviewed just like anybody else's and have gotten really great peer reviews, which means doctors or other people with diabetes have given feedback on the articles on how to make it better and have said, you know, publish it or not. So that all has been a really, really great thing. There's just like those little systemic things about like getting your research into the system and the same steps where traditional researchers might have people to help or they might have a team to work with. In some cases, I'm working on things independently just because it's easier. And other times I can't get anybody interested in the work that I'm doing yet. So I have to do things kind of first on my own. I'm starting to do that with some EPI and diabetes research. And I'm having a little bit of a harder time trying to get into the GI journals than I did the diabetes journals because with diabetes, I had, you know, been talking publicly about open source AID for a couple of years before I submitted my first research article. So people kind of knew who I was and they were willing to work with me to get through the system. The GI world has no idea who I am. And, you know, submitting articles as an independent researcher, they seem to be a little more gatekeepy. So that's kind of an ongoing thing. But the diabetes world has been, and the diabetes journals have actually been really, really great about that. And the doctors and the researchers have been willing to, you know, evaluate my research just like it's anybody else. So I've been pretty thankful that that's not been an issue on the diabetes side, but it has surprised me a little bit now that I'm jumping into some of these GI journals, how it does seem to rely on networking in a way that I wish it didn't, because it feels like a systemic gatekeeping thing that unnecessarily is slowing down scientific knowledge.
Hmm. No, it's really interesting because it's also, obviously, I suppose I know you more from the diabetes side, but it sort of amazes me or it blows my mind now how much data there must be from people who've looped and donated their data, that is such a big data source. How many people sort of request to use it?
Oh gosh, I had this number at the top of my head a couple of weeks ago and I've just forgotten. So the data set now, we have over 180 people who have very kindly donated their data, which is amazing. And thank you to each and every person who's done that. I just did a publication with somebody analyzing when the data set was 120 people's worth of data. And there was like 40,000 days worth of diabetes and AID data, which is phenomenal. So obviously with 180 people, that data set's even bigger and more awesome. So thank you to everybody who's donated their data. We've had several dozen people request the data for research. One interesting phenomenon I've noticed about people requesting the data for research is there's not a lot of big CGM data sets out there. So I would say half of the requests so far are just people who want blood sugar data to do machine learning prediction type stuff on, which isn't the most high impact thing that they could do it on. And it's not like we're going to give this thing directly back to the community. So it's not really my favorite group of researchers to work with, although they meet the terms and they get to use the data, that's fine. But we are starting to see more and more researchers come in who actually understand AID and diabetes, and they're not just interested in the BG data. They're also interested in the insulin dosing data and the human behavioral data about any carb entries, any targets as it relates to activity, and are thinking about how can we learn from this? How can we make recommendations to the community of people with diabetes to improve their systems or improve how they interact with their systems? And that's really, really exciting. So I think we're starting to see a nice snowball there of people leveraging this data set to its full potential, which I think is awesome. So that makes me really excited.
Oh no, there's just so much information there. And like you say, I remember even before I looped with you saying about pre-bolusing, and even if you only gave half a unit ahead of time, it just makes such a difference that you're sort of prepped to eat and things. And I think that even goes for people on MDI. So it's not even just pumpers or loopers that's really there. But anyway, I shall let you go. Thank you. Lovely hearing you again. And hopefully one day we'll be able to meet for a drink again.
Oh, I would love that. And I think you were just talking about eating soon. And I think I'm pronouncing your name wrong. I apologize. But Gore had said, what can we learn unexpected about diabetes? And Flipper was just talking about this idea of getting a little insulin going before a meal. That's what I call eating soon mode. It's been really effective. I started using it before I had a closed loop. It was when I was doing things manually with my open loop system that I realized that if I had a little bit of insulin going, it made a big difference. And I learned that because I had a night where I was running on the low side. I wasn't actually low because I kept setting low temporary basal rates to reduce my insulin, and my blood sugar was perfectly in range. And I went to have a nice Saturday morning brunch, and my blood sugar skyrocketed so freaking high. And I'm like, this is weird. I should not have gone that high. I had bolused for my food. But then I realized, oh, I've been reduced insulin all night. So I had negative IOB, negative insulin in my body compared to what it's used to. And so the way the carbs hit my blood sugar and the way the insulin from my meal bolus hit was differently. And that's what kind of gave us the aha of, well, maybe if we try to reduce the negative IOB and try to get a little bit of insulin without causing a low blood sugar, that's what led us to discover eating soon and realize that that could happen. And this is the kind of thing that you see as a person with diabetes and you want to try to solve for, but the commercial systems may or may not have this concept of negative IOB or this concept of, you know, telling people that they've been reduced for so many hours and that might have an effect on the next thing that they do. So I think there's still some things from what we've learned in open source, like eating soon mode, this concept of net and negative IOB, and this idea of showing the predictions that commercial systems don't do yet. And I still think that not everybody needs that, but for a lot of us, in the right situations, that can be really, really helpful. So I would still love to see the commercial systems you know, have these calculations, even if they're hidden down a second menu, they're not on the main menu, fine, I'll click a button, but I want to be able to see this data. And that's the kind of thing that I think, not that anybody's asking me, but I'm often asked about, oh, when would you stop using OpenAPS? And it's, well, when there's a different system that, you know, does all the basic things that I found really, really helpful, like the ability to track net IOB. Because whether it's for heading into a meal or heading into exercise, which you know, happens every single day. I eat and I exercise. That's just crucial for me having the best outcomes for me. So personally, I still think we have a ways to go into helping the commercial system see how people with diabetes would benefit from these types of features.
It's funny you should say that, because on Saturday I was at a tech exhibition, and I've recently jumped ship and gone to a Tandem for various reasons, but it's working well for me, so I've no complaints. But there are features like that, it doesn't show you. And in the UK, we don't even have the app. So even though it doesn't give you that information, you can see from the graphs how much under, you know, you are normal, bowl, you know, how much less negative IOB you've got. And I was talking to the rep and said, but why would you need that? And I'm like, well, A, doesn't matter why I'd need it, I want it, but these are the circumstances. And she just didn't get, do you know what I mean, what I was saying, mm-hmm. for why it was so useful. But then having used, I think Android APS really helps me, because I know what I'm looking out for, and I know, do you know, like, I use the tricks I've used in DIY, and now just using my Tandem, which makes it work. But anyway, thanks a lot. It was lovely hearing from you.
Well, I love what you're talking about, of using the tricks that you learned with DIY and open source to help you with commercial, which is awesome. And that's like, I feel like I learned so much with what I call DIY PS and then open APS, that if you took away all my technology and I just had MDI and finger sticks, or MDI and CGM, I would still be so much better off than I was before, because of all that I learned because of those tools. And I'm so grateful for that, because again, you know, you learn so much about the fundamentals, and it, once you've solved a lot of the ups and the downs of the blood sugars, you have more mental and physical capacity to ask questions and be curious and to learn and to problem solve in a way that you don't when you're struggling with your blood sugar going up and down constantly.
Oh yeah. And it's like the Tandem, the algorithm works the same way as Android APS. It works the same way. So the tricks that you use to work with the algorithm, so that you're not triggering it to do something, you know, it's like you can't really carb load before exercise, because it will just start giving you more insulin, because it's predicting you're going to go high. And it's just working out how much you can do to push it, or ways around it, so you're working with the algorithm rather than against it. And it just makes such a difference to how you, the results you get.
Definitely.
Yeah. Anyway, I will let somebody else get on now.
Absolutely fascinating, Flipper. Just loving the conversation. And it's nice to have this space. And I'm just sitting back just with a cup of tea and enjoying the chat. It's amazing. Right, let's go to our last sort of section, diabetes advocacy and peer support. I know we've touched probably bits throughout the evening, really. You've been a massive advocate for diabetes and open source. How has the landscape changed in the 7 years that Open APS has been around?
You know, I feel like when I first closed the loop for myself, you know, I was always very careful to say, I don't know that this would work for anybody else, but I'm going to make it open source so that if somebody wants to choose to use it for themselves, they can. And then as people did that, and they very kindly, you know, shared their data, enabled us to do the first research publication, you know, there's now been dozens and dozens of studies, some retrospective on the data, like we were talking about, some prospective studies, a randomized control trial just finished using the OpenAPS algorithm. The results are going to be presented next week at ADA Scientific Sessions. And it's a big deal that there's an RCT on the algorithm that we built 7 years ago. So it just feels like there's so much more data. There's obviously many, many people using it who very kindly on social media and through studies and, you know, talking with their doctors have shared their experiences. And it's just open source and DIY is a thing now. And it's not just Dana being kind of an oddball. I mean, people might still think I'm an oddball, that's fine. But, you know, there's so much data and evidence from the broader community. And I think it's really powerful and it's changed the conversation. So instead of saying, should people DIY? Oh gosh, that sounds scary. It's more about, you know, what are the ways people can be effective? What are the pros and the cons to DIY or commercial or, you know, any technology that people want to use? And so I think the conversation has really, really broadened, which I think is awesome and where it should be. One of the things I'm hoping comes out of our experiences in diabetes is that other communities with different healthcare conditions you know, whether it's cystic fibrosis or cancer or people with asthma, you know, if they want to start using open source devices or apps or systems that help them track or use their data or their devices, that they will not have some of the same hurdles we had in diabetes when we really had to demonstrate what is open source, how can open source be used in healthcare, how can evidence be generated by a patient community and, you know, used by and work with and partner with traditional researchers. What does that look like? So instead of it being 7 years, maybe it's a 2 to 3 year evolution for that community. So I'm hoping a lot of what we've learned in diabetes also ends up helping, you know, other health area communities as well.
And how awesome would that be, right?
Yeah.
Just incredible. What do you think of like the role of peer support, maybe just in general, like what does peer support mean to you? And then in terms of sort of the sort of open space community,
I mean, peer support is huge. I am always so, so grateful for the, when I was diagnosed was in 2002. And at the time I didn't know anybody with diabetes and I felt very, very alone in part, again, because of the stigma that I experienced in Alabama with type 1 diabetes. You know, and it was, I finally realized that I wanted to do something and to try to help other people because I thought that was the best way to help myself was to really, you know, not focus on me, but see what I could do to help other people. And that seemed to work really, really well. I felt better and felt like I did my diabetes better by trying to support other people. And that introduced me to communities of people. And I've met my best friends and people who came across the country to my wedding, who I met on the internet. And it's just been really incredible. And these people are still some of my closest friends to date. And like during the pandemic, these are the folks that I talk to because they get the challenges of being somebody with a chronic health condition in a global multi-year pandemic. You know, they just get it the way that, you know, people with diabetes get it. We get the experiences that we have, even if we're different genders and races and locations, there's just a shared connection through diabetes. And that nod and that empathy of people who know some of what you're going through, or know enough to listen and ask the right questions, that's just invaluable. So I personally benefit from it. And one of the things I hope for anybody when I hear that they are, you know, struggling or having a hard time is saying, you know, there's these really great communities online. Doesn't matter what platform you're on, there's people with diabetes out there. And maybe it's one person or maybe it's an entire chat of 30 something people, but you know, try to reach out or show up or just lurk, and there's people who get it. And that may be the thing that really, you know, changes everything for you, because that's what changed it for me.
And do you have a sort of peer support group for your open APS? Do you have a group that people go to, or is it just through like tweets and stuff that people may just network?
Yeah, it's kind of everywhere. I was pretty vocal about what I was doing, you know, with the start of OpenAPS, because there was no community at the time. There weren't these big Facebook groups. There was no Twitter chat for diabetes. There was no Twitter Spaces, wasn't a technology. You know, there were just in-person things. And I wanted to help start to connect with people who didn't know about this technology, but wanted to learn about it. So that was one of why I already liked Twitter, but I was using Twitter specifically to kind of like share my journey as I went along building this thing and using this thing, in hopes that people who stumbled into it would benefit from it if they wanted to use it. So that was a very intentional choice, was not to create a specific group for it elsewhere. We used platforms like Gitter and GitHub in terms of like troubleshooting and building and how to get started. But there was never like one closed wall community just for OpenAPS. Because it didn't, like, there were so many great diabetes communities out there. I wanted people to still be a part of their communities, like, come in when you need technical help, but otherwise, like, go live your life, be on the platforms you want to live on.
Does it
just be integrated in the real world?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess people tweet you and like tag you and stuff, and obviously people who are obviously doing the open APS, like, how does like them interactions like spur you on? Like when you see these tweets, is it nice to see that people are doing these things or whatnot?
Oh, it's so inspiring. I think Allison just tweeted saying she heard me speak at Rise of the Machines in 2018. And she says, it still truly feels like anything and everything is possible to help us live our best lives with type 1 diabetes. And it just, I have goosebumps on my arms because, you know, I just feel like anything, diabetes is hard. But we have tools to help make it easier. We have the connections with each other. We have things that we each are learning and teaching each other about, you know, things like how to deal with exercise or how to deal with certain meals or, you know, how to deal with a kid going off to school and remote monitoring. Like there's all this real world stuff that doctors don't know and the healthcare system doesn't know. And it's really up to us to figure it out and then to turn around and share it with one other person. And I always said with OpenAPS, it's worth open doing all the work to clean this stuff up and post it on the internet and make it open source, because if one other person benefits from it and sleeps through the night safely, it's worth it. And so
amen to that.
Yeah. Every tweet I see just, you know, and sometimes I'll get tweets on days when I'm like, they'll just be out of the blue and somebody will just post a tweet like, hey, I just started looping, or like, here's something I did while I was using, you know, Android APS or whatever. And to them, it's no big deal. They're like, hey, I just want to drop a note. And then it's just, you know, I'm having a rough day for whatever reason, like just, you know, frustrated by the pandemic or life or whatever. And it just, it just gives me this incredible boost of, you know, yes, I've spent hundreds, if not thousands of hours researching and talking and doing all this stuff for free. I don't get paid for that. But all of that is worth it for that one person in that one moment. So just thank you. And thanks to Allison for providing a really great timely example of the kind of messages that are just really rewarding for me. So thank you.
Incredible. Thank you so much. We had a question from Chris on the hashtag, and it kind of probably ties into about the future, really. What you kind of hope, or what you sort of optimistic for the future in terms of where the journey of diabetes will go? Do you think there'll ever be a moment where there'll be a device in your body that can detect highs and lows, and it just, like, you're not having to use like CGMs and all this sort of devices? Do you think there will what's your vision? What do you think will happen in the future?
Oh, it's so hard to predict the future. I would love that. It sounds great. Realistically, how do we get there? I'm not sure what it takes. But I think it's easier to predict like what's going to happen in 1 to 2 years, just because technology can jump quite a bit.
And I think, like, if you just look in the last couple of years, technology has just evolved so much, hasn't it? And even if you compare the decades, like 10 years, 20 years, 30 years ago, it's just changed so much. And like, and with like the advances of things like Flash and Libre and different CGMs, you know what I mean? There's so much out there, and it's it feels like it's a good time, doesn't it? It feels like there's optimism in the air, and yeah, it does feel good.
Yeah, it does feel like it's a great time to be living with diabetes with the tools and technologies that we have. And it'll only get better.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. A final question from me, really. What would be your final tips and advice this evening to anyone that's listening? It could be a parent who has a child with diabetes. It might be someone who's recently diagnosed with diabetes. It might be someone who's had diabetes many, many years. What would your sort of advice or tips be to them?
Everything you're facing and what you're challenging is real and valid. And there are potentially solutions out there, whether it's a duct tape hack together type solution of do it yourself, or something more sophisticated. There's a lot of tricks that the community knows. And so if you're struggling or you have something that's really bothering you, and you think it maybe doesn't feel like a big deal to anybody else, but if it's a big deal to you, it is a big deal. And to reach out into the community wherever you can find and say, here's my problem. Does anybody know any solutions or have ideas? And then also to feel free when somebody says, okay, here's a solution, to say, that doesn't work for me. What else can I do? Because there's often multiple solutions. Like there's multiple open source systems. There's different pumps you can use, different CGMs, different algorithms, different features. And that's just talking about AID, of course. And then if you think about strategies for meals and exercise, there's lots and lots of options. But I would say reach out, ask your question, say, here's my problem. Help me solve this. And just realize that there's a lot of opportunities. And if the community hasn't solved it yet, you might be the one who has the best answer. And you should absolutely share that back with the community, because it will, if you think you have a problem, then somebody else has the same problem and could benefit from learning from what solutions you've come up with so far.
Absolutely brilliant. And Rich's final thing said, Dana, your book changed my life, along with peer support from my local area in Derby. Such a massive load off my mind, allowing me to live a much better life. such a fantastic community. Long may it continue. And thank you so much.
Well, you're going to make me cry. Thank you, Richard, for those very kind words. And I'm so pleased that you're doing well.